Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. I'm Rachel Neal.
And I'm James Ramsey.
For the second year in a row, WNYC is bringing you inside the Tribeca Film Festival with panels and discussions featuring some of the biggest names in films today.
We'll hear from people like Spike Lee, Courtney Love, and Nate Silver about not only some of the biggest projects coming to movie theaters this year, but also what's going to be on television and on your smartphone.
But first, what better way to kick off an indie film festival than with a panel about how indie films get made? Today we bring you The Producers.
Okay. I can't really sing. I have to sing goofy in order to sing. Like, I have to sing stupid. Okay?
Okay.
You always hurt the ones you love. The one you shouldn't hurt at all.
Oh, Blue Valentine.
Right? And the thing about that movie is it just sounds so real. Like, that's the first date that I want.
Yeah, it's emotionally gripping and it's honest. But there's also, just in terms of movie making, it seems so simple. I mean, there's no explosions or car scenes. It's like they just turned on a camera and started filming this relationship.
Right, and I was really surprised to find out that it took 12 years to make, 66 drafts of the script, and there was a ton of problems over the money.
Hey, girl, that sounds like a lot of work to get a movie made.
That's a good one. Independent films can be just as hard to make as big Hollywood blockbusters, but without the big budgets.
One day, the storm's gonna blow, the ground's gonna sink, and the water's gonna rise up so high, there ain't gonna be no bathtub, just a whole bunch of water.
Beasts of the Southern Wild was shot on location in Louisiana and used an almost entirely local cast and crew.
We'll hear from the producer of Beasts of the Southern Wild, along with the producer of Blue Valentine and others, on this panel, The Producers.
Welcome, everybody. We have a great group of panelists today. I'm sure you're familiar with Olivia Wilde as the famous and beautiful actress.
Thank you.
Is also insanely smart, and that's her little well-kept secret, but... She is here at the Tribeca Film Festival with, this is not your first produced movie because we're going to count your documentaries as well.
But, oh, thank you. Good. Bonus.
But she's here with, I'm sorry.
Meadowland.
Thank
Don't
you.
Don't worry, there's lots.
And you are probably very familiar with our other panelists' movies. We have Carly Hugo here, who, Bachelorette, obviously, a big, fun movie that everyone... And then we're going to show all of your clips of your recent movies. So I'm just going to throw out your highlights.
Yeah.
And then Alex Orlovsky. Am I pronouncing that correct? Alex has done... He has produced The Place Beyond the Pines with Bradley Cooper and Ryan Gosling. And Eva Mendes, and he also did Half Nelson. I think you have at least 3 Oscar nominations from your films, if I'm not mistaken. 2? Okay. Ryan
for Half Nelson. Michelle for Blue Valentine.
Exactly. Yeah. And he also did Blue Valentine, yes, of course. And then we have Matt Parker, who has produced many movies with Carly, so there's a lot of overlap with them. He had Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was nominated for a Best Picture 2 years ago?
I think so.
Yeah, that was the an incredible journey, that movie, from tiny movie to, you know, a big Oscar contender.
Absolutely.
Maybe let's start with Alex, because I think that the Wolfpack is really indicative of the constraints that indie producers face now. Like, how do you even go in and pitch a movie, like, to financiers to get financing for a movie like that? What's your pitch? I'm going to make a movie about this family on the Lower East Side that hasn't left their house in however many years and watches movies all day.
Absolutely. It is very indicative because the director didn't ask for anyone's permission and basically did it herself for a number of years. And we actually, you know, I mean, documentaries are different from features in that, you know, she shot this for 4.5 years, and it, you know, premiered at Sundance this year. We got involved probably, we got actively involved, I'd say, a year ago, and we're sort of, we're helping from, like, a consulting standpoint, gave them editing space, gave them a little bit of money, but it was a project that had been out there, and I think a lot of people in the industry had seen it, but it just hadn't sort of hit critical mass yet, I would say, and it's actually a good lesson for, I think, for directors and producers, that there's a right time for a project where it's sort of all the pieces, you know, they may be apparent to you, but they might not be apparent to the world at large or to the industry, and sometimes you have to just kind of keep scrapping until that one, you put that one other block in place where people look at it and say, oh, this makes sense, like, I'll get behind it now, you know? So,
okay. Yeah, and now, indie film producing, unlike regular film studio film producing, I shouldn't say regular film producing, but studio film producing, it is something that there are, like, so few guarantees that this will ever, you know, be distributed in a platform where people will see it. So what makes you all seem like sane people, a sane person, pursue this, you know, line of work? Anybody? Olivia, you don't have to.
Right, I didn't mean to. Well, I would say that, you know, once you spend a bunch of your life making movies, you learn a lot of lessons, and you feel that you understand the process, and you feel you know how things should be done, and then you really want to facilitate the good stories. I mean, that's how it came to me, is that I'd been working for 12 years as an actress, learned from some really fantastic producers, And I felt that it was time that I use those lessons and turn it around and try to help someone I really respected, in this case, Reed Morano, our director, make this film in her directorial debut. But it is something that now that I truly understand, having executive produced before, but now having truly produced and understanding how difficult it is, now it's something that I want to continue, because now I can't help be that pushy and nosy when making a film.
Right.
It's like, once you understand that you can actually affect change and you can actually help the right decisions get made and push good movies through and find them financing and stand up for them and fight for them, then you really want to do that, because there are so many stories out there that should be told that just need that last element, need someone to really fight for them. And so I found that to be a worthy effort and something I can't wait to continue to do.
And I'm just curious, who are some of the producers you had worked with in your 12 years of acting that really, like, sort of you learned a lot from or influenced you, or, you know, you take a lot from today?
Well, I mean, having worked with all different types of filmmakers and their teams, you know, I think having worked with everyone from Spike Jonze to Nick Cassavetes to Jon Favreau, and learning different things from these directors and the people who are helping them make their films, and understanding that, you know, on the set of Her, Megan Ellison was really just allowing her filmmaker, in that case Spike, to make the film he wanted to make. And I watched her very closely, and I noticed the differences between her and maybe some other producers I'd worked for, and I just feel like I picked up little things along the way. Also in television, which, you know, the producers are a huge part of television because they are the consistent part. Your director is always changing. Your producers, who are often your writers and showrunners as well, are people who are possibly spending 5 years with you. So I had a lot of time to learn about nuts and bolts of producing from them and how to really handle a crisis.
Okay. And Carly, you have done both comedy, which a lot of people don't think of when they think of indie movies. They think of indie movies, dramas, you know.
I've done my fair share of those.
One of the most successful independent comedy movies when you, you know, count those gigantic VOD numbers,
right,
that, you know, Bachelorette really changed sort of the conversation about how a movie could be distributed.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, that clip from Mother of George. You know,
and that's actually that's a film called Five Nights in Maine that we shot in October.
Okay,
and you guys are the first people to see anything besides the.
I was going
to
say that this is an upcoming movie.
Yeah,
obviously, very dramatic.
Very dramatic. Yes.
How do you sort of straddle both worlds?
Well, I think that, and Matt and I together, we have worked on a large range, like you said, comedy. The majority of the films we've done have been the million-dollar drama films, but we find that the story is the same, and being able to champion the story and filmmakers, whether it's a comedy or a documentary, it's at the heart of it, it's the same sort of stuff. So I think, as your question earlier about why would people be so insane as to do this, I think that the ability to feed our ADD of wanting to work on a million different things at once, it's really exciting to be able to work on a comedy and at the same time be developing a film about grief, which is what Mother Five Nights in Maine is about. So I think that the skills are all the same, whether it's a documentary, which we've also been doing a lot of lately, or a big comedy. You're championing a filmmaker and trying to help them get their story out there.
And how about, do you find it more receptive in terms of, like, financiers or whatever, when it's comedy versus drama, or?
They're all pretty hard to get financed.
Yes. How many doors? I mean, is a door, like, slightly ajar if it's, like, comedy versus?
Well, I think that Bachelorette was a special case. It also had a very high-level cast for the budget level it was. So
right.
That allowed foreign sales to be higher. It allowed people to take the chance on Leslie Headland, who wrote a very dark script.
Right.
She
was Harvey Weinstein's former assistant. So.
And we were making that right. It was the summer after Bridesmaids, and it was just the mantra was this is not Bridesmaids, and making sure that everyone knew that we wanted to support her in making this really twisted view of female friendship. And allowing her. So I actually think Bachelorette is very indie in its own way. I think it has commercial aspects, and it has the fancy, shiny actresses, but...
It did commercial business.
It did commercial business,
which
thankfully.
Is, like, a difference. Like, Beast of the Southern Wild, same thing. It's, like, it's an indie movie that did commercial business, you know, because it happened to have that sort of critical, you cannot miss this movie. Had it not been nominated for Best Picture... It may not have been seen by, you know, it would definitely not have been seen by as many people as it was seen by.
Quite a bit when it got nominated. But it had won Sundance and things like that that helped it get to that point. It had a nice rise up to that point.
Now, you obviously are starting to do a lot more documentaries, correct? What is it about the documentary field right now? It just seems particularly explosive. I even think I've heard of, like, the Wolfpack. People are talking about buying the feature remake rights for the Wolfpack. That's become sort of this, like, hot new area of documentaries. They have such great stories that people now can just buy, Hollywood can buy a documentary. They have a blueprint for a movie's narrative. And then they can make it. But documentaries, I think, also, there's just so many more places to show them now. Thank God for Netflix and all these places. But, you know, is this something that, like, you can just make a full career doing nothing but documentaries? And
For Carly and I, the documentary thing, I had done one small documentary several years ago. It was super hard. But recently, we... joined forces with Graydon Carter, who's the editor of Vanity Fair.
Sure.
And he had this Nora Ephron documentary that he was getting set up with HBO, and he was like, do you want to produce it with us? And I was like, sure. You know,
directed
HBO.
Directed by her son.
Yeah. It's, but, you know, the difference in that and, like, the other one I was talking about is the budget. I mean, the HBO documentaries, we're on our second one now. They have a really nice, healthy budget. We can pay crew well, you know. We can pay ourselves well. So it's made it a lot easier for us to do documentaries. I think, you know, like working on a documentary for 6 years, you know, that's usually like the two people doing it. It's super tough. And if somebody doesn't come and, you know, at the end, like Alex was talking about, and rescue them, you know, that doc might never get finished or make it to the festivals or whatever. So, you know, there's like, I don't know, there's I think, two worlds of documentaries. They're like the, you know, Alex Gibney's, and then there's the people on the ground really making these real stories, you know, that aren't like biopics.
How many movies does Alex Gibney produce in a year?
Like 20.
Yeah, like he's like the Rembrandt. I think there's going to be like a whole group of people doing it under him, but it's like, I feel like every 3 months there's an Alex Gibney documentary.
It is. Definitely.
Not that that's a bad thing, but... now, Olivia, you are probably the only one here, I'm guessing, that appears in the movie you produced. Is that correct? Unless you guys have cameos that I don't know about.
Yes. Which was my original way that I discovered the material was as an actress. Read the script and thought it was sensational and met Reed Morano and was completely blown away by her. And wanted to help get it made. And so I asked if I could join them. There was a guy named Matt Tauber already on as a producer. And I said, can I please join you? And I'll do whatever I can to help get it through and get it made. And it was really challenging. And it's interesting from an actor's perspective, seeing the financing process, which these guys know very well. But once you see those lists with all the actors listed by value, and you're like, where am I? Where? Oh, gosh, I'm just down here. At times it was really infuriating. And I was very lucky to be a part of a project that had high standards for the type of collaborators we wanted and financing producers, and we weren't willing to completely sell our souls.
Right.
And so we waited, and we found a tremendous company named Braun out of Canada, a guy named Aaron Gilbert, and Margot Hand, who's now split off, and she's an independent producer now, but they let us do what we wanted. And yet, you know, there's still the realities of casting, that, you know, they said, we really want to let you cast this unknown person, but we would love it if you would consider these people. And I did find it interesting to watch the process of financing a female-driven film starring a woman, directed by a woman who's a first-time director. You know, there's a lot of obstacles there, not just the gender situation, but also first-timers. And, you know, we had to find someone who really trusted us. And it was illuminating.
Had you done another movie with Reed?
I'd never worked with Reed.
Oh, wow.
But she's this incredible cinematographer who's got such a great reputation. And now I believe that more directors should come from the cinematography school. I mean, it makes so much sense. The extraordinary thing about her is that she, because we had so little money, she decided to both direct and DP the film. She also operated.
Oh my God.
So she's tough.
She's very tough.
It really, you know, I'd worked with great DPs before. Ben Richardson, actually, who shot Beasts, did Drinking Buddies, which I was in and executive produced. And he's also an amazing DP who's really active and a part of the process. And Reed, as the director, cinematographer, and operator, created a very different environment on set. And we were able to, just in terms of logistics, also save money because of time. Because that lag time in communication between director and DP was not happening. She was making decisions. And also creating this incredibly intimate bond with the actors. And we had some child actors as well, so that was really helpful.
You're listening to Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. Coming up after the break, we'll hear more from the producers.
Talk about the finances, anyone here. What do these movies that you've been involved with cost to make? What did they sell for at a festival? Or, you know, can you give a sense of the finances? Because I think most people just think, like, whatever the box office is what, you know. And
I love seeing people will give me sort of like pitches with movies of mine in the comps with just completely wrong numbers. And they're like, this movie needs this much money. And I'm just like, A, no, B, take that out. Like, so yeah, it's always very deceptive because, and I think the trades like inflate numbers. Whenever you see Sundance, it happens on occasion.
Not
sometimes,
me, of course, but
yeah,
at the festival circuit, though,
yes.
I will say for sure that yeah. I see it happen
all the time.
No,
just festival announcements when it says a movie sold for seven figures.
Right.
Generally, you know,
it means $500,000.
Exactly. But I mean, I think it's a good time to make sort of million-dollar films right now with the advent of all these new buyers and, you know, I, like all the VODs sort of bringing back what DVD lost.
Right.
Netflix, Amazon. There's just, it's competitive, and our attorney, who probably repped all of everyone else's movies or something, said that...
Do you all have the same attorney?
Andre.
Andre, yeah.
Okay, so Andre DeRochet sells... He handles the distribution legal for a bunch of these movies, and he was said that a huge number of his films from Sundance came out in the black. But they're all sort of same size, you know, in this sort of space, and I think it's great that that's a model that's sort of working right now, but I think as a producer it becomes a speculative thing, because you're never going to get paid on one of those movies. You get paid if it sells.
It bleeds into like the sustainability of being an independent producer.
Yeah. It's a very, if you like gambling, then independent producing is a good line of work for you, I would say. Because that's kind of what it is a lot of times, but it's like placing 2-year bets, you know? And when it works, it's great. When it doesn't work, it can be really hard.
Sort of going off what Olivia was saying about finding financing for those smaller character-driven female dramas. Five Nights in Maine that Matt and I produced with, that was the clip, first-time female filmmaker, and it's, like I said, it's a David Oyelowo plays a young man who loses his wife, and he...
Was it before Selma, by the way?
It was before. We shot 2 weeks after Selma.
Okay.
So he was in the process of starving himself during our movie.
But it's great you got him, like, when he's...
Well, he's a producer. He's a producer on the film. He actually was on board...
He was attached for a long time.
He was attached before we were. We got the project, some friends of ours, a wonderful production designer, Chad Keith, and Bradford Young, who's a DP who did Selma. They were originally brought on the project, and they brought it to Matt and me. And at that point, David was already on board, and that was about 2 years before we shot. So he had been very involved the whole time. But we brought the film basically to everyone for financing, hoping to find one or two people or companies to come in and do it together. And it was just, it was too difficult. So it was just pass, which is, it's hard to then be pitching knowing that people aren't responding to it. It makes it a really... just discouraging, but we had to start from scratch and really try to figure out the best way of doing it, which in our case was to assemble a lot of grants. We got a great grant from San Francisco Film Society and CineReach. We actually just got a Tribeca All Access grant because we're still raising money. And we ended up assembling small investors in the $25,000 a piece range, which means now we have however many people that is, a lot of people to manage, but it just is what it is. And that is not a model that is easy to, because then the film becomes about financing. Which
a lot of the small dramas, like Mother of George that we did also, is an African immigrant drama, was like half grants. The Ford Foundation came in and gave us a really sizable one, but they don't give to narrative films anymore. But, you know, if you're making a $1 million and below drama, you're like relying heavily in half almost of the financing. It's going to be grants. They're just like including Kickstarter in there, but it just has to be. It's really
difficult.
Which means
that the equity portion is lower, so there are some benefits to it. We can make that money back quicker on a sale, but
okay. Now, one of the things I think is nice, all four of you are New York based, correct? I mean, is there even such a thing as an L.A.-based independent producer? Probably not.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are moving.
I think New York's got the... You guys have... New York has the stranglehold on the indie. But maybe... and such a great venue that Tribeca provides for independent filmmakers. I think that in New York, independent filmmakers and producers also get more respect than... anywhere else. There's, you know, do you find that? Do you find that when you know, are elsewhere?
I don't know. I think when I take the meetings in LA, I feel like there's a little bit of a, like, how do you guys live there? Like, how do you pay your rent? Like, there's a little bit of that, which I actually think kind of plays nicely. I mean, I think that the New York film community is incredibly close and whatever the opposite of backstabby is. I feel like very, I feel very comfortable like sending projects around, and I feel like in general we're all sort of helping each other up.
Right.
I don't always feel that in LA.
LA is a little bit like The Player.
Yeah. Yeah. Great movie.
That movie was sure was.
So we've a part of that.
It seems as relevant today as ever. So you find a camaraderie here.
I love it.
And I think the crews are great here. I think this is New York's a great place to make independent films. I think in terms of just the quality of crew that you can access on a smaller film, I don't think you can really touch it anywhere else in the country. And I've tried, you know, with really, you know, difficult results.
Right. The tax credits are still...
Tax credits are great. And I just think that although TV's had an effect on crew, because I think so many people just work on TV shows now, and you can't really blame them, to be honest. So I think that availability is a little different from what it used to be, just because there's so much consistent TV work. I love making movies here.
And it's Olivia, great. Where did yours shoot? Here. Okay, in the city.
In the city, a little bit in New Jersey, but here.
Okay.
I went to your production offices.
You did?
Yeah.
They were very fancy.
They were.
They
but yeah, I mean, and it's like you share the crew. Like, their production accountant was a production accountant in one of my films, so I had to go there to, you know, to wrap some stuff up. And it's like, that's also great. It's always, there is a real sort of family feeling, and I think an awareness of, oh, that just shot. I've heard that's good. Oh, this is happening.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really an enjoyable sort of family to be part of, I think.
What would you give as advice to a would-be independent film producer coming up? Let's start with you, Matt, because...
I don't know, it's I always tell people that come into the office that are starting out, like, concentrate on story. Like, when you're making your first film or producing your first film or even directing it, like, I think a lot of people get caught up in, like, you know, the best camera and lighting and everything. And now that with the, you know, with the advances in digital technology, like, they have these DSLRs that you can shoot a whole feature on that are small, and you don't require that much lighting, and you can really, you know, for like $500,000, shoot a really good movie. You can be nimble, and you know, but it's about getting the coverage and telling the story, really, and not wasting a lot of your time all the day with, I think, on an entry level movie with lighting and things like that.
Not cast either, not a cast, like, that's not the biggest consideration. Like, can I get a name person?
That's a big consideration, but, you know, I just in terms of, like, being able to get as much story on the screen,
right.
You know, use these things to your advantage. Like,
and it depends on what kind of movie somebody aspires to make. I mean, that's also a question I ask people, is just, like, what kind of producer do you want to be and what kind of movies do you want to make? Because different answers... I would give different advice to different people, but it is pretty amazing that you don't have to ask permission anymore. Like, you can take a 5D and go make a movie, and no one can tell you not to. You know, it means you may forgo lights, you may cast, you know, friends and family. But I think working on other people's films and working for people who create work that you admire is really important, because that's also where you get... You know, that's your crew. And then I've seen it so many times, people are like, oh, I'm going to make a short film, but I'm going to ask these five people from this movie I just did to help me out for free. And they will, because now they know you and like you. And, you know, that's the way a lot of careers begin. If you want to make studio movies, move to LA. You know, I mean, or like make bigger movies. Like, and I give people that advice all the time.
Right.
You know?
And how about you, Carly?
I think it's very important to be fearless and really to go out there and like Alex said, make something. Don't just sit around for 2 years worrying about things. I think it's also very important, you had said at one point, not having cast. I think that it's also important, if you're going to spend someone else's money, to understand that the way that the marketplace right now, you cast is a factor. Not saying that there are very big exceptions to the rules, and we've done exceptions to that rule. But I also think that you have to, when you're starting out, like, always be thinking of the end goal. Where do you want this? Which distributors do you like? Which distributors do you think that this would be the right fit for? Like, keeping an eye on the final product is very important. And I think that as producers, it's important for us to know that world for the director so that they can relax into, as they said, story and into the more artistic side of things. And we can sort of help guide them. And but I think for beginning producers, I just go make stuff.
Just do it.
And working on a short film, it's the same skills. Working on a small documentary to a large comedy, it's the same scheduling problems and the location fell through and we need insurance. Like, it's the same
process.
Yes.
How many movies have you been a fully producer credit on?
Full producer credit? 10 to 15? I don't know. Something like that.
Like 10? And you're like 25 years old, right?
I'm 30.
You're all like 25.
Yeah.
I was just going to add to that, and in terms of the casting part of the process, from an actor's perspective as well, it's a good idea to get creative with the way you make offers and also not immediately surrender when, let's say, you're making a film and the male role is not as big as the female role, and the financier says, well, if we bump up this male role, we might get a bigger male actor and then we can make this movie. I think it's really worth resisting that and sticking to your guns and telling the story you really want to make. And if you can't get an actor to accept that small role, they're not right for that role, don't change your story to try to beg an actor to be a part of it. If it's a good story, they're lucky to be a part of it. And I think in terms of how offers are made, just understanding that process, that sometimes the agents aren't delivering that material in the way that it should be delivered. Sometimes the lookbooks you've created aren't getting to the actors. Sometimes the letters the directors are writing aren't getting there. So as a producer, really working hard to build this cast that will get the movie made, just following through on that and making sure that you allow the actor to really understand what they're being offered and who the director is. I just can't tell you how many times I've passed on something because it just wasn't presented to me in the right light, and then later seeing it being made and being like, wait, what is that? I didn't know it was that. Or directors see me and say, did you get the letter I wrote or the lookbook I sent? I'm like, I don't know. That never got to me. So just from the producer's standpoint, I really tried to keep that in mind when we were making our offers, and it really helped to follow through and try to communicate directly as much as possible.
I like this point of sticking to your guns, and especially about like who's right for a role. I have this great anecdote. I was talking to the producer of Winter's Bone a few years ago, and they were having a terrible time getting the financing for that movie. And the potential financiers wanted, okay, if you can get Britney Spears or Miley Cyrus. You know, Southern actresses with a name. None of this Jennifer Lawrence crap. And they stuck to their guns. They wanted somebody who could act, I guess. And, you know, the rest is history for Jennifer Lawrence. But
wow. I think Britney Spears would have been fabulous.
She would have, skinning the squirrel and everything. But, you know, you think of, like, these movies and you can spot when a concession was made, and I won't name movies, but like you can always spot when that concession was made for a name actor that maybe isn't right for the part.
I think that's a really good point, and I think people forget to be patient when you're making offers and just when you're trying to get a film cast. And I think it's one of the hardest things, especially as a producer, when you have a director who's so determined to get this film made, and sometimes you're catching a lot of heat from said director, and sometimes just for personal reasons, you're like, I need to make this summer or else, and you'll compromise on casting or just not, you know, not really think something through. And I think a movie lasts forever, and if you make a casting compromise or any other kind of compromise to get it made, you're going to be watching that film in 10 years and thinking about that compromise. And I mean, Blue Valentine I personally tried to get that movie made for 5.5 years, Derek for 10, and we had so many people pass on it.
Wow. Who passed? Curious.
Really? Oh, God.
Britney Spears.
We probably did offer it to her, but like, I mean, I probably shouldn't say any of this stuff, so I'm not going to, but
there's no reporters here.
Hundreds of people. Yeah. No, I mean, literally, like, 30, 40 actors, ranging from ideas that seem good to ideas that I tell people, and they're just like, what? You got to be kidding me. And we almost made the movie in a couple of those versions. I mean, it was, but Derek was a first-time director. No one, and I actually remember taking to an actress's apartment, to her doorman, like VHS tapes of like his short films, his commercials, like all these things to try to sort of convince, and this goes back to what you said also, it's like, especially when you can't get a face-to-face meeting between a filmmaker and an actor, it's sort of translating why something special can be really hard.
Yeah.
But I think just like wait, be patient, your projects will get made when the time is right, and don't make the wrong version of it just so you can say you made a movie. You know?
Something else about the timing, which is not related to that, but related to compromising on timing, I think it's also, it's important to also not rush your film for a festival date just because you happen to be almost done and you've got 4 weeks left till Sundance and you just throw something out there. I think that's something that we've seen before, we've done before, and you always regret that you didn't take that extra time because, like Alex said, films last forever, and that's something that we've been talking a lot with our directors about is, like, patience is key because if you rush to make a movie, but it comes out soon, rush to make it soon, and it's not the thing that you want it to be, it's not going to be the calling card you need it to be for your next film and for the next and the next. So I think it's something that, as producers, we have to also sort of temper, manage, not expectations, but manage that timeline and allow the director to understand that there's not only one festival. There's not only one summer to make your movie in.
How about, Olivia, speak to the dearth of female directors, even in the independent film space.
Well, I don't know if there's actually a dearth. It just feels like it because so few of their movies get made.
Right. And they're certainly much better than the studio. I mean, there's far more female directors working in the independent film space than there are in the studio film space, where it's like, really.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems that way from my perspective. And I wonder if it does have to do with how difficult it is to get their movies made. I think as a producer, you're taking on an extra challenge. I think that it is changing. But, you know, it starts from the audience really demanding those films and supporting those films, and then the numbers line up and people will make those films. But I was actually shocked at how, even though our director was a very accomplished cinematographer and very well respected within the industry, still seemed to be having a tougher time because there was this sense of like, well, won't it be hard for her? And it was like, what? Why? What? She's handled very, you know, incredible directors, and she's been on sets and she has so much experience, more experience than some of these first-time directors who are writers who've actually never worked on a set, and they're getting the opportunity. So I think people are afraid of taking that risk because, you know, as everyone's been saying, it's a gamble. It's a huge risk. And you do have to remember you're spending someone else's money. That's a thought I had many times throughout the processes. I was getting frustrated, and I have to remember I'm gambling with someone else's money here. I have to understand why they're being cautious. And it is a lot about handling their fears, as well as your director's fears and insecurities, and making sure that everyone is maintaining, you know, their patience and confidence. Even after you get rejected from a festival, or before that stage, every actor passes, then you actually make the movie, then you get rejected everywhere, and maintaining everyone's, I've found a lot of producing is maintaining everyone's enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that is an important role. So, but in terms of the dearth of female directors, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of them out there and a lot of them in film school right now, and it's up to producers to really champion their work, and I'm excited to do that. Well,
I would love to hear each of your future projects that you're just starting to work on as producers.
Like Matt said, we have a couple documentaries that are in post or shooting right now. The film that I'm very, very excited about right now is we have a film called Faith, which is based on a New York Times bestseller from a couple years ago. and it is a big, meaty family drama, and really excited about adapting it and getting it out there.
Is it what's the plot line? Is it
the plot is it's about a family in Boston in 2001 and
your hometown
in Boston, yeah.
And
the oldest brother in the family, who is actually going to be played by Chris Cooper, he is a Catholic priest and he's falsely accused of molesting a child. And the film is told through the younger brother and sister's point of view, figuring out whether or not he's innocent and how, and really reconciling how do you trust someone who is your older brother, the person you looked up to your whole life. What do you do then if you don't believe in him? And so it's sort of the family dynamic, how it shifts it and changes it.
And who's going to direct it?
We don't know yet. Oh. We're working on it right now.
Olivia, do you want to get into directing or is producing?
Yeah.
I can send you the book.
Yeah, make the deal right now. We have to
exchange cards at the end. Now, Alex, what have you got cooking?
I'm waiting for Mike Cahill's next script, which I'm excited about. Who directed I, Origins and Another Earth. So should have that hopefully in a week or two. And that's it's a big science fiction movie.
So that will not be an independent budget.
The definition of an independent film, I think, continues to expand. So.
Yeah. He's great. I was on a panel with him recently, and I think he's like the next Darren Aronofsky.
That is my hope.
Yeah.
it's about what would happen if humans and aliens interacted, but not from a sort of horror movie alien perspective, I think what you traditionally see, but something maybe a little more humanist. I mean, the same way that he's explored other big ideas through kind of a more human lens. But I think also, in the sort of Loop or District 9 vein is the hope. We'll see. I'll tell you once I've read the script.
Okay.
And then working with a director named Charlie McDowell, who did The One I Love.
Yeah.
That was at Sundance last year. That script's called The Discovery. And it's about a scientist who proves that the afterlife exists and the societal consequences of that. And then I have a movie in post that Gerardo Naranjo directed, stars Dakota Fanning, Zoe Kravitz, bunch of other great young actors. We're trying to finish editing. So.
Nice. Sounds like you're busy. Matt?
We're finishing a Mission to Mars movie with Mark Strong and Luke Wilson right now. We're finishing the visual effects on that. And one of the cool things that we're developing right now is a stop motion animation feature, which there's a reason why people don't do them on a low budget, but we're going to try.
It is the single most expensive version of animation, correct?
And slow, yeah. It's the script got into the Sundance Writers Lab, and we're supposed to hear on the Directors Lab any day now. And it's one of the first animated projects to go through the labs. Hopefully in the next year we'll start prepping that and shooting. We're also developing like a puppet movie that's really fun. The past year we've really been trying to generate a lot of ideas in-house and then kind of like find filmmakers for that and build them in-house, which has been a lot of fun and new for us. So.
Sounds like you're busy.
You're listening to Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC. Coming up after the break, we'll hear more from the producers.
And Olivia, you're always busy.
Well, I'm producing a film called FML, which a great new director who's a documentarian named Amy Rice is going to direct. And it's me and Jenny Slate, and we're casting the other parts now. And it's a great, weird girl comedy. So we're working on getting that made, and it's a challenge. It's a very different challenge than Meadowland, being a female-driven drama, female-driven comedy. It's just a different thing, so I'm learning about that now.
Why? you'll probably still hear, can she do that?
Will she be okay?
Oh, progress is slow, isn't it?
It's happening.
Now, do we take questions from the audience? Now, I'm sure you guys, after all of this, discussion, have plenty of questions. Does anybody? Oh boy, how about you?
Yeah, hi. I shared the log.
Oh, wait a second. We're going to get you a microphone.
I'm part of your family because I share legal. Andre, I have Evan Krauss of Gray Krauss as my lawyer. So, how do I get a script to you guys for consideration as producing?
Good question.
Through Andre. Okay.
Sure.
Okay, I'm Barbara. Don't forget.
All right.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see half the panel, or more than half, women, because I remember when they were not there. They were just possibly a moderator, but now we have women producers, and it's terrific. And NYWIF, New York Women in Film and Television, is a wonderful place for women to be groomed, and I'm a NYWIF member. So Cool. Thank you for today.
Thank you.
And I think Tribeca Film Festival, we really have to give them a shout out because this year I think the theme is women power. Sorry, guys, but it's about time, right?
Yeah, I think there are over 30 female directors in the festival this year.
That's amazing.
Yeah, very cool.
Let's see. Who else has a question?
I'm definitely a different generation from everybody here, so I'm studio-based in the sense I know all these stories about Dino De Laurentiis and these guys that go right to studio. Am I right? With all the dot-com billionaires out there, nobody is the big money bucks daddy who wants to give you guys money because evidently you guys don't make enough money, so they just go right, because you've been talking about grants and HBO and independent. So there are no individual rich men who will give money or women to independent film. Why
is that true?
Well, Megan Ellison, but she's a woman.
There's a lot.
Yeah. There are plenty. But they give, they have advisors who tell them, to do things in a logical manner. And so no one's ever just, it happens rarely, but, people give money to projects. I think it's hard to create a sort of business model around being an independent producer, but we have very, very wealthy people fund our projects all the time. They're out there for sure.
You just have to find the really crazy rich people.
Yeah.
We're telling the horror stories, but there are those people.
There's a lot of also like incredibly wealthy people who do it very in an almost secret manner. I forget which football team, but one of the football team owners, like the Minnesota Vikings, he finances tons of independent, the small $250,000, $500,000 movies.
Sure. And those people are getting hit up from every industry, it's really hard to get to them. And then when you do, you have to present it and win them over, and just like anything else. But they're out there.
You. We may have to wait for your microphone. Did you guys catch
that? We can repeat. How involved were we in the artistic choices?
For me personally, I think that I always want to support what the director wants first. I think that I definitely don't gravitate towards saying no first. I'm always like, yes, let's make it work. There are some times where logistically, or say they want to cast a complete unknown. Just for example, we did a film, Higher Ground, a few years ago that Vera Farmiga directed, and she wanted, it was right after Winter's Bone, we had a lot of the Winter's Bone crew on our film, and she wanted 100% unknown actors. And it was about, okay, that's great, but then it will never get out there, so we ended up populating the cast with mostly Broadway actors. So it's all about figuring out, what do you want with this actor that you're all excited about, and if we can't get them, who can we find you that fits into that slot? So it's all about, for me, I think that I get involved in the artistic in the way of supporting, and I think that it's very rewarding.
Hi, thank you. It's great to hear all of you. especially you, Alex. I just produced, wrote, and starred in a short film with Frederick King. Frederick King was involved in the project. He's from Blue Valentine. He helped develop that film. And I'm going to be in Cannes next month with a feature film script that's related to the short. So my question is how to make the best of that experience, especially when I know exactly which producers I'd like to work with.
That's, you know, I mean, I think you have to just, don't be afraid to talk to people and just, I mean, put yourself out there, try to build a consensus of people who will support you and sort of be helpful. I mean, Cannes is a sort of bigger and more of a Wild West situation than something like Sundance or Toronto, but we can have a sidebar conversation about it afterwards, but I don't know if you guys have any thoughts.
It's like learning to ask for things, you know, and how to ask for them, and to get like the guts up to go up to somebody and present something in the right way.
And be realistic, actually. If it's like, I don't know what size your script is or what it is, but find people who the first answer is not just going to be a straight no. Mm-hmm. And it's people who, like, people come up to me all the time, but it's like, ask me for something reasonable that's like, oh, this person actually has thought this through and there's some sort of, like, logic behind this. It's not just, you know, like a pie in the sky or sort of unreasonable thing, because people will turn off pretty quickly.
Yeah, you can do your research. I think it goes hand in hand. Like, the internet, there's so much information out there on these producers and what they've done, and you know, you can see their body of work and you know, find similar projects to yours that these producers have done, and do your research.
Yeah, and tailor those conversations to, even if it's like, I will IMDb in the bathroom real quick to be like, okay, I'm going to talk about that. Like, but even if it's just knowing who you're talking to, so that you can.
Yeah, and assistants and junior agents, honestly, are sometimes even a better approach than the most important person in the room, because they're more likely to get behind something and support it because it can be something that they can take ownership of, rather than going straight to, like, you know, somebody who's the actual decision maker at a company.
They also read.
Yes, they actually will, like, read things.
I think too the how you deliver your pitch, whether it's a short film that you've already made or whether it's a script. Recently, someone brought me a project, and the pitch was so well crafted and so well thought through that it was just perfectly ready-made, and I was immediately interested in jumping on board. And I was just so blown away by it. So I think really making sure that the pitch you present is ready.
And you, and then I think this is going to be our last question. Sorry, everybody. I know you guys have a lot of questions. This type of discussion makes for a lot more questions.
Hi. So what advice do you have for future filmmakers and directors? Would you suggest that we should first team up with a producer that probably has done some things? And do you also completely discourage the director producing themselves if it's maybe a first project?
Do whatever it takes. I mean, there's no right answer, but
I do think if you are directing and producing, make sure you have someone else with you, both because it's probably easy to lose perspective as a director a little bit and to see the bigger picture, but also there will be minutia details that the producers have to deal with that it's important that the director doesn't have to always have their head in all of that. So just make sure you have a team around you that's supporting you if you are in that position.
You don't want to be the only director and the only producer in a project. Trust me.
Well, thank you guys all. I think I'm going to make a bold prediction and say that Alex's The Wolf Pack is going to be nominated this year for Best Documentary.
Woo!
At the Oscars. Matt, you will be back at the Oscars again, and you'll probably have like a better tux this time. Not that your tux is bad. Olivia and Carly, you guys are going to really have an amazing response to your movies. And
can we go to the Oscars too?
Yeah, can we? Our gowns
are ruining your car.
Yeah.
Great.
I think so.
So thank you guys all.
Thank you.
On the next episode of our show, we'll hear from costume designer Catherine Martin and Vogue editor-at-large Hamish Bowles about the glamour behind The Great Gatsby. That's next time on Tribeca Film Festival Live from WNYC.